Back chat.
Politics and current affairs.
Back chat.
Your alternative to talk back.
Hello, it is Saturday, November 25th, and you're listening to Backchat, where we bring you the stories of Sydney and beyond. We're broadcasting from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation and pay our respects to elders past and present. Hello to my hosts for this week. Hello, Holly. Oh, it is the 2nd of December. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I wouldn't normally notice, but it was my birthday yesterday, and I need to tell everyone.
Happy birthday, and hello, Nick.
Yes, good morning, everybody out there. Hope you're all doing well.
So what's going on in the show this week, Holly?
Earlier this week, you, in fact, chatted to the 2023 Nurse of the Year, John McAllister, about his legacy of care here in Sydney for patients with HIV.
Later on, we'll be continuing our coverage on protests in New South Wales. Have you been arrested at a protest or known someone who has? It seems like more and more people are getting arrested at protests these days, and we want to know why. Stay tuned to find out.
But before that, how are potholes on your commute? Bus ride a bit more rocky than usual. Funding for potholes Australia-wide has a $1 billion deficit. That's with a B, and we'll tell you why.
And of course, if any of that pricked your ears, then get in touch. Have you been to a protest? Text us on 0409 945 945 or DM us on Instagram at BackchatFBI.
All right. Well, one of the biggest contributors to a bad start or end to the day is the humble pothole, the potential consequences of which could endanger your life. I wish I was being dramatic. I'm not. Potholes have become a staple of the cities as we see more wheels on the road, more people in the cities, and the demand that follows. But while we all love to complain about councils seeming to never fix the potholes in our areas, it turns out the maintenance of those potholes is something which is running in a deficit. We're joined by uneven surface enthusiast and Backchat producer Nick Huntington to find out why. Nick, hello.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, ladies. How are we doing?
Oh, so well. Now, what's the deal with potholes?
Now, what's the deal with these potholes? Well, look, there is
they're
a dramatic...
potholes, Jerry.
A dramatic difference. Yeah, they're not just a little hole. They're a pothole. And there's a dramatic difference in funding, to put it a bit bluntly here. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons. Climate change, you've got environmental maintenance obviously going up. Protection is receiving additional funding, as is health. You know, we just had a little thing called COVID. I don't want to say the bad word on air, but yes, we did have that. So there's a lot of places that are getting a bit more funding, and that's meaning that the funding for these roads is going a bit in the backwards direction. But the scale of difference, it's pretty dramatic, because, I mean, currently pothole maintenance nationwide, it's operating at a $1 billion deficit.
What impact does that have?
Well, I mean, depending on where you are, this gets worse. I mean, remote areas, they face more than 75% in their funding shortfall, with this dropping to 40% in remote areas, and cities, it's around 14%. So us in the cities, we're quite blessed with this. But it results in remote communities being cut off at times from the deficit and maintenance. You know, you go out to really, really remote areas, if the road is unsafe, it's unsafe. You know, you can't drive full stop. So that means that, you know, food and supplies can't even get in to some of these communities. And so, I mean, for any problem like this, the immediate thought that most of us have is to just throw money at it, right? Unfortunately, it's not that simple. So I spoke with Senior Associate of Transport and Cities Program at the Grattan Institute, Natasha Bradshaw, about what the situation is with future funding changes.
A really big one is that freight is growing rapidly. So the freight task has grown about 20% over the last decade, and yet maintenance for local roads has only increased about 1%. And it's trucks really that do the most damage to our roads. Cars don't actually do very much damage. Now, there's plenty of money going around for new roads. The government has already committed to spend $120 billion over the next 10 years on new infrastructure. But what the problem is that not enough money is going to looking after the roads we already have.
So the cost of living crisis means there's just less funding for everything in general, right? But the delay in picking up maintenance shortfalls also means that the problem is getting worse. So it's a bit of a rock and a hard place for these local government bodies.
So with funding not coming into the right areas, what are people going to do to fix this?
Well, this is a major problem. For those looking to solve this in New South Wales and Victoria, for one, we're the states that have got rate caps. So obviously this kind of issue is usually covered by rates. You know, as a taxpayer, you give your taxes over to the big man upstairs, magically makes the roads get better. I mean, Holly, I believe, you know, you have potholes that do get fixed. You're one of the blessed people.
Yeah, I had a bad pothole in my laneway and I was so angry about it. And then it like magically got fixed one day and I was like, wow, I feel a lot safer, but my identity of person who complains about pothole is been absolutely stripped from me.
Devastating.
Devastating.
Look, spending has dropped from almost 50% of local government spending back in the 60s to less than that, 21% today. So the complicated issues that we're facing now, you know, they're obviously quite different to the 60s. It's a different economy, different pressing issues, but is this drop justified? Text in and tell us.
What's that number?
What is the number, Beck?
0409 945 945. Thank you, Nick, for giving us the down low on potholes for this week. Next up, we'll be talking to Legal Observers New South Wales about the arrests at protests in New South Wales recently, and we'll hear from someone who was arrested at the Zim protest. Before that, here's the latest from June Jones. This is Bubblegum. You are tuned into Backchat on FBI 94.5. Did you go to the Zim protest 2 weeks ago or know someone who was at the Newcastle climate change protest last week? Were you arrested? Text in your experience on 0409 945 945.
Hundreds of people protested in Port Botany against the Israeli international shipping line Zim, and the police arrested 23 protesters. We spoke to a protester who was arrested that night.
For the first couple of hours after the police gave us access to the road, everything was super peaceful. We had our speeches, but then at about 9 o'clock, they decided to go up to people and give them what we thought was completely non-valid move-on orders. No reason was ever given, so when I was told, I never felt a reason to comply. That's when two police officers just started to drag me by the armpits. They tried to lift me up, but they failed. Because of that, another police officer ran in, tackled me to the ground from my seated position. Another couple of police officers started jumping onto my legs, but they were trying to move me around. That didn't end up working. So at the end of the day, a police officer just asked if I was willing to move on. At that stage, I'd had my fun, so I decided, yep, just leave. They moved on to women and people who they could move on it more easily, and that was really the predominant amount of people who were arrested.
Whilst 100 protesters were arrested in Newcastle just days later while blocking a major coal port, with there being more protests and arrests of protesters in New South Wales, we brought along Anastasia, one of the coordinators from Legal Observers in New South Wales, to chat. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
Now, Legal Observers have been at the major pro-Palestine protests in Sydney. What have your Legal Observers observed at these protests?
Yeah, so we've been seeing really, really high amounts of surveillance at these protests as compared to previous ones. We've seen police employing mobile CCTV technology, just indiscriminately filming everyone in the crowd and also filming people on body-worn cameras and special police evidence-gathering teams. And there's no real accountability for what police do with this footage. For all we know, they're collecting a mass bank of data of people who participate in protests. And we've also seen massive over-mobilization of police, so 200, 300 police at these protests for what is essentially a very peaceful, well-marshaled crowd marching through the streets according to the route that they've planned. And there's just been a total, I think, overuse of resources on these protests. We've seen the Premier complaining that they're spending over $1 million per protest. But from our perspective, from what we see on the ground, most of those police are just standing around not doing anything. Last time they had about 50 police officers blockading the Starbucks to protect it. So it was just, we're seeing a misuse of police resources, we think, and also indirect kind of intimidation of protesters through this high visibility policing. And as we see, there is a real threat that police can turn violent very quickly, as we've seen at Port Botany. So we're very concerned about the way these protests have been policed.
Let's take a step back. So a while, the government passed some laws around protesting that were pretty controversial a while ago. Can you give us a quick rundown on what those were?
Yeah, so the anti-protest laws that were brought in 72 hours last year, they were rushed through Parliament in less than 3 days. Normally, a bill has to sit for 14 days before being passed through, made it punishable by 2 years imprisonment or a $22,000 fine to obstruct a road or a major facility. And that includes things like pedestrians having to walk around a protest in order to get, for example, to a train station or in order to access a port. So even redirection, which is a very, very low threshold, of course, now counts as obstruction. So we are obviously very concerned, and there's a big civil society response against these protests. Amnesty, Human Rights Law Center, Council for Civil Liberties, and actually a lot of unions as well have condemned these laws as being anti-democratic. And we've seen that police have tried to basically use these laws to justify harsher policing of protests, to treat protesters as more as implicitly criminal just for protesting, even before they've even done anything. So that's been one of the concerning aspects of that. And I think that we haven't seen this major facility charge used in the past before Pot Botany. So it'll be interesting to see how these cases go. And it's a real test of whether these are democratic laws or not. There is a constitutional challenge happening against them led by the Environmental Defenders Office. So we're hoping to see, obviously, an outcome in that, that it is against the freedom of implied political communication in the Constitution. But yeah, we're waiting to see how it plays out. And for the moment, protesters just have to deal with being criminalised.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio, and we're joined with a representative from Legal Observers New South Wales to deep dive into policing at protests in New South Wales. Now, what's the role of legal observers in these protests?
Yeah, so the role that we try to play is making people aware of the rights that they have with police and making sure that they can make informed decisions about what they do and stand up for their rights. We also monitor police action and produce reports about it so that there can be accountability for what police do at protests. We see police misusing their powers a lot in informal ways in protests that just don't get captured unless someone is there to capture it. For example, like this surveillance issue, there hasn't really been much reporting of it, but we think it's a real significant civil liberties issue. And we also connect protesters with legal support. So we've been helping to coordinate some of the legal support for the ZIM, for the people arrested at the ZIM protests.
The idea of being filmed is, yeah, quite scary. But what can people do if they're in that situation?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that we advise people to do in terms of safety going to protests, is think about ways that you can protect your identity from this mass surveillance. So we do advise people to mask up if possible, depending on the kind of protest you're doing. Sometimes strategically, that's not what you want to do, but do try and keep that surveillance in mind. And also when posting photos and videos of protests online, if there is any possibility that people are being charged for that action. We know that police have actually been going through live streams of protests and picking people out to then charge after the fact. So things like that, we want to make sure that if people are being charged at the protest, it's best to be careful about the kind of footage that you post. But with all this in mind, I think it's really important that we're not intimidated by this kind of conduct from police. It is what they want us to do, is to be afraid of going to protests, to be afraid of, you know, showing up for the causes that we care about. And the best fight we actually have against these protest laws is continued mass mobilization and affirming the right to protest and affirming our capacity to do that without being surveilled and harassed and assaulted.
Yeah, I mean, hugely important. And I suppose, what kind of bail conditions are those that are being arrested at protests been given recently?
Yeah, so we've seen, especially for these more serious charges, I think that the conditions have been really concerning. So one of them has been that people can't participate in unlawful protests, which is a meaningless term legally because there is no offence of participating in an unlawful protest. You can do things that are unlawful, like obstructing a road during a protest, but unlawful protest is not a term in New South Wales, and it's really not great that police are trying to make that a thing, and we shouldn't let them make that a thing. On a broader level as well, people have been banned from going within a kilometre of any Port Botany entrances, which is, of course, a very difficult, like, you know, if it's not something you want to be thinking about in your everyday life, whether or not you're going within a kilometre of Port Botany. On a broader level outside of these protests, we've also seen people given non-association conditions with everyone belonging to a certain political group. So there was some protests by an anti-militarist group, Wage Peace, 2 weeks ago at the Naval Defence Conference in Darling Harbour. And the police tried to enforce bail conditions of not associate with anyone who's a member of Wage Peace, which is the kind of stuff that we see used against frankly, you know, terrorist organizations or organized crime. So it's very telling that police are treating protests in this way. And they actually identify a certain protest group as, quote, interest-motivated groups, and have that as sort of part of their lexicon of this is almost like an organized crime organization that we are trying to disrupt by preventing them from talking to one another. And we've also seen conditions of people not being able to use encrypted messaging apps like Signal, which is obviously like a huge impingement on people's capacity for privacy and capacity to avoid police over surveillance. So,
now, this is wild. Now, Anastasia, for those listening who are thinking of going to a protest this weekend, what's the most important thing they need to know about their rights when being arrested?
Yeah, I think don't talk to cops is generally just good advice. There are very limited circumstances where you have to give your name and address to police officers if they think you can assist in the investigation of a serious offence, or if you're about to be given a move on order. But outside those circumstances, it's best not to speak to police officers or give them any details about yourself. I think also just having safety mechanisms in place, like going with a buddy, having somebody knowing that you're going to a protest, and also police, when they're exercising any power, they have to tell you why they're exercising that power. This is one of the things that we saw as we heard from the protester. The move on order that was given, there wasn't actually any reason that anyone heard for the police giving that move on order, and that's actually a function of making it a lawful order. So you can always ask if someone is exercising a power on you from the police, you can ask what is the reason you're exercising this power, and that really helps with creating an evidence base of is this a lawful thing that they did or not. And also try and have someone filming. Legal observers are out at as many protests as we can get to. We try and film all police interactions. If you have, if you witness any police interactions at protests and there wasn't a legal observer around, please send it through to us on Legal Observers New South Wales at protonmail.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp.
Very good. Anastasia, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
This was amazing.
That was Anastasia, one of the coordinators from Legal Observers New South Wales, breaking down the policing of protesters in New South Wales.
Next up, we're going to hear from the 2023 Nurse of the Year. But first, here's Keanu Nelson. All right, and now for some good news. Earlier this week, producer Beck Kushwe chatted to the 2023 joint winner of the Nurse of the Year Award, John McAllister, with a long career history right here in Sydney, helping patients diagnosed with HIV. Here's Beck with a bit more about his story.
Have you or a member of your family ever been treated by a nurse or midwife who went above and beyond the call of duty? Have you ever wished there was some way you could recognise them officially for all the work they've done? Our public health system has had a rough couple of years, with the after effects of COVID still being felt by health workers across the state. As the largest health system in the country, New South Wales employs more than 50,000 nurses and midwives. Following four historic statewide strikes in 2022, the push towards safe staffing ratios has still yet to be achieved. Nurses and midwives have had a more difficult job than usual, not only providing care in an understaffed and underworked system, but also maintaining passion for an industry that doesn't often award a lot of recognition to its employees. Sponsored by the New South Wales Government, the Excellence in Nursing and Midwifery Awards exists to work towards that recognition. The 2023 awards happened last week, marking the first in-person event since 2019. With a diverse array of categories, winners from various corners of the state snagged recognition for everything from outstanding leadership to lifetime achievement, and of course, the big one, Nurse of the Year. Now, being awarded Nurse of the Year is always a big deal, but this year the joint winners both happen to be male nurses. While New South Wales has the largest health network in the country, only 11% of those nurses in that network are male. The joint winners, Trent Williams and John McAllister, are two of only a handful of other male nurses to be awarded and recognised at the Excellence in Nursing and Midwifery Award in the history of the awards. Just last year, the Nursing and Midwifery Office received complaints of gender discrimination due to the lack of male nominees in the 2022 awards.
And the winners are John McAllister from St Vincent's Hospital, St Vincent's Health Network. And Trent Williams from John Hunter Hospital, Hunter New England Local Health District.
There was one health network that stood out this year, and it was the St. Vincent's Health Network here in Sydney. It claimed 3 wins and 1 other nomination. St. Vincent's Health Network covers several facilities in Sydney, but St. Vincent's Hospital is the most recognisable name. Joint winner of the Nurse of the Year Award, John McAllister, has been a St. Vincent's nurse for 33 years, working as a nurse practitioner in the HIV and sexual unit. John initially worked in the St. Vincent's Cardiothoracic Intensive Care Unit. However, by the early 90s, the impact HIV was having on the community and amongst his own friends and peers became the catalyst for a change in focus. And in 1993, he started working in the St. Vincent's HIV ward, 17 South. It was here that John's passion for HIV nursing began, forming the foundation of his career and a lifeline for so many young men and women.
I was thinking about how long I'd been a nurse when I was on the train, and I first stepped onto a ward in 1976, so that's 47 years now. I mean, when I first started working in HIV, there wasn't treatment, so we looked after desperately ill, mostly young men, high acuity, lots of death. My journey has been able to see the evolution of treatment, and the treatments when they first came along in the early 90s to mid-90s, they were rough and ready. I saw a young 21-year-old guy this morning in my clinic who started treatment today, and he's just going to take one pill once a day. He won't even notice it. Probably one of the most fulfilling things about the job is to know that you've been there for that process, holding that hand and just being there and listening and doing what you can. It makes me feel good.
St. Vincent's has a high number of people living with HIV or at risk of HIV infection living in its vicinity, and the largest HIV service in Australia. Ward 17 South treated half of the patients in Australia diagnosed with the virus. To date, established in 1984, the clinic treated at least half of all Australia's HIV patients and played a vital role in caring for those who are living and dying with the virus. To date, more than 35,000 people have been diagnosed with HIV in Australia, and as many as 11,000 have died. But the HIV/AIDS epidemic is no longer the epidemic it once was, and John McAllister has been a huge part of that picture.
Sometimes it's tough, and sometimes the wins in what we do are small, but we just keep being there, keep going there, keep doing what we do best. We're nurses.
The Excellence in Nursing and Midwifery Awards are nominated by consumers, that is, patients, family, you and me. So people like John McAllister can be recognised for their lifetime of dedication to caring for patients here in Sydney and taking care of our community. So keep an eye out for the 2024 nominations, and you can shine the light on someone who has provided amazing care or had a huge impact on our local community.
But that's all we've got time for today. Of course, a big thanks to our guests, Anastasia and John McAllister.
And a bigger thanks to our producers, Sana Sheikh and Nick Huntington. This has been Backchat. We'll be back with the news from your city and beyond next week.